Good afternoon. Welcome to this afternoon's session on ethics in science communication. It's a great pleasure to me personally that there is such a session, and as a communicator of science, and it's something that I've noted from the very first night in the wonderful Béla Bartók Concert Hall, that the subject of communication comes up repeatedly and the important role that it plays in the scientific endeavour. My name is James Gillies. I'm a particle physicist by training, but I've been working in communications at CERN for the last 25 years. In that role, the ethical dimension of what I do has never been far from my mind, because communicators, whether scientific or otherwise, are in the business of shaping opinion, of getting people to do what we want them to do. And there are many ways of going about that. And are they all ethical? I don't really know. Well, I do, actually. Some of them are definitely not. I mean, I can give you an example of the things that we train our scientists to do. If they're confronted with a journalist who's asking them difficult questions, there are things you can do to buy time, and we tell them how to do that, and they really do work. We always tell our scientists that, you know, answer the question. Or if you really don't know the answer, tell them you don't know the answer, but that you'll find somebody who does. But the next time you watch a politician being interviewed, watch that, because a lot of these people use such techniques to deflect questions and get rid of them altogether. And you may not even notice, transparently. So there are many, many aspects to the ethics of science communication, and I think the subject would merit a conference in its own right. So please forgive us if we don't cover everything. I want to introduce something from my own experience that I think is not something that often comes up in discussions about science and ethics, but it's something that is very important from a communication perspective, and it's based on something that happened at CERN, and I think it's also linked to one of the real challenges that science faces in the modern world today, in equipping the world, individuals and society, to make the right decisions that need to be made based on the evidence available. And the story is this, that for a long time at CERN, we were very excited about a new facility we were about to start up called the Large Hadron Collider. And we wanted to tell the world what a fantastic global endeavor this was, what great things can come when people from around the world come together for common purpose, all about the wonderful science that it would open up. But we didn't do that. What we spent our time doing was telling the world we're not going to create a microscopic black hole that will swallow the planet. And I hope that we did that in a scientifically rigorous way, but an ethically responsible way as well. And reconciling those two things is not as obvious as you might think. And I remember very clearly one night, one of our leading theoretical physicists appeared on a late night American satirical news show, and he said, the probability of this happening is zero. What he meant from a scientifically rigorous perspective is that the absolute upper limit on something like this happening, based on our observation and knowledge of proton-proton collisions, is less than 1 in 10 to the 100, or some equally incomprehensible number, right? Zero, to all intents and purposes. Was he being scientifically rigorous? No. Was he doing the right thing? Yes. Was that ethically the right thing to do? Maybe we'll have time to discuss that later, but the point that I want to make is that a challenge that we have as science communicators is that the public come to science for certainty, and that's a real problem. They want absolute certainty. They want to be told what to do. And you know, we as science communicators can easily communicate about discoveries of Higgs bosons and Nobel Prizes, but what we really need to be doing and what we really need to learn to do better is to be able to discuss the process of science, which is about using the evidence that you have available to make the best possible decision that you can and being able to change your mind if the evidence changes in the meantime. And we need to be able to do that in a way that is both scientifically rigorous and ethically responsible. So that's just something there that I just throw into the mix. Now, in this conference, we're going to be using Slido. I don't know if the sign is up there. We're going to be asking questions of you as we go through. Yep, so I guess you're used to the drill by now. If you go to slido.com and type in that code, you will be able to answer a question. I'm going to put up a general question at first, and then later we'll be putting in questions as we go through. And if there's time at the end, we might revisit the questions, some of them, to see if we've managed to change your mind as time goes on. So in science journalism, in journalism in general, there are very strict codes of conduct and ethical behavior. And you might argue that in some elements of the media, they're fraying. I think in most of the scientific media, they're holding up very well. But for somebody like me, I trained as a physicist. This came up in one of the morning sessions as well. And what I learned was physics, nothing else. I worked as a physicist. I had no elements of ethics or anything at all. I'm not bound by an ethical code of conduct. So the first question I'd like you to answer when it comes on the screen is, should people like me, should communicators of science, be bound by an ethical code of conduct? And whilst you're thinking about that, I would like to introduce our keynote speaker. On the basis of 15, 100%. I would fully agree with you, actually, for what it's worth. I'd like to introduce our keynote speaker. Magdalena Skipper is editor-in-chief of one of the most prestigious and influential science journals in the world, Nature. A geneticist by training, she holds a PhD from the University of Cambridge, and she moved to Nature in 2001 to the journal Nature Reviews Genetic as associate editor, moving on to edit that journal before being appointed editor-in-chief of Nature last year. I can think of no one better to open this session. Please welcome to the stage Dr. Skipper.
Thank you very much for the invitation and for the introduction. And I will first attempt to open my slides. But while I'm opening them, in case you're interested have an example of, really an exquisite example of how a politician avoids answering a question, then listen to pretty much any interview with Michael Gove. I live in the UK, so, but anyway, I digress. So I was tasked with speaking to you about ethics in science communication. And indeed, we could have a whole conference devoted to this topic. And this 30-minute presentation could have gone in all possible directions. I could have talked about all sorts of things. And I decided to talk about principles that guide us at Nature. And of course, Nature has a journalistic part as well as the research part where we publish work of many of you here in the room. So that's what I will focus on. And one thing I want, as I speak, I want you to keep in mind the fact that as far as I'm concerned, you are all science communicators. So there are, regardless of what you do, whether your job description, your job title is a science communicator, whether your job title is an editor, a scientist, whatever else it may be, you are communicating science, so you're science communicators. So I will talk about this from this broadest perspective. So just to give you an idea what kinds of topics I will cover, I will start by talking about ethics in Nature's journalism. Then I will move on to talking about diversity in our voices that we give a platform to. I'll share with you a few lessons from our past. We just celebrated our 150th anniversary. So there was a lot of sort of gazing back over our history, which I found incredibly instructive, actually. I'll talk about authorship and the responsibilities that come with it, ethics in editorial decision-making, ethics in peer review, and then I'll spend a bit of time talking about competing interests, what we think about it, and how we treat that issue. And I'll end by giving you some examples of how we grapple with issues of bioethics and biosecurity in our papers, and then also say a few words about transparent research, which to me is absolutely wrapped up in ethics of communication, science itself, of course, but also its communication. So I suspect that all of you know that Nature has a magazine journalistic part. If you are still one of those people who picks up a physical copy of Nature, that's the first part of that issue that you will come to. And there are essentially two types of content that we publish in this front half of the journal, as we call it, and that's opinion and journalism. What I'm showing you here on this page is just fairly random examples of editorials that we published relatively recently. The editorials in our pages represent our opinion as a journal. They are never signed, they never have been for the last 150 years, and they're always written by us, so we don't have guest editorials as such. The examples that I'm showing you are deliberately illustrative of the kinds of topics we talk about. We don't just talk about science, but we talk about politics, policy, societal issues when they pertain to science. That's always our focus, of course. There is, of course, also journalism. That journalism has, broadly speaking, two formats, news stories, which are very rapid in a way that you may expect journalists to produce them and sort of stories to turn over. But then we also focus on, in a much more detailed, often way that involves investigative journalism in our news features. And again, we touch on some very difficult issues, which may be difficult for political reasons or for reasons of for social reasons. So our journalists have a specific ethical code of conduct. This code of conduct, the ethics policy for our journalists, is actually not a public document, but it's an extensive document which all our journalists are familiar with and are bound by. So the principle that guides us is really not surprising, but it needs to be stated. Our goal is to be accurate, to be fair, to be authoritative, and to be independent. And very importantly, this goal applies both to the published content in our pages, but also the way we work. And so that's a goal we strive towards. Our primary responsibility is to our readers. And you may wonder why I say that, or why I emphasize this. And the reason why I emphasize this is because we are editorially independent from our publisher. So this is really important. That allows us to do independent journalism. And that's not just for journalists, of course. It's also for editors who review scientific manuscripts. So that's an absolutely crucial point. Many aspects of this ethical code for journalists are actually common with any ethical conduct for any journalism. There's one important distinction, and it's my next bullet point. So we tend to avoid this false equivalency. So in politics, it's common to give equal time to differing opinions. For us, the situation of the landscape is a little different because, of course, research is backed by evidence. And so not all views are based on sound science, and very clearly those views will not be given equivalent prominence in our pages. We think very carefully about conflict of interest, both for our journalists and our editors, and I'll say a few words about this later. When we think about conflict of interest, we think about both financial and personal. So financial is probably obvious, but personal involves personal relationships, former employment, and so on. And again, we take that seriously. So one example is, of course, journalists who have personal relationships with, let's say, researchers in a certain institutes will never cover stories from their institute, and similar examples of that abound. We actively strive for diversity of sources in our journalism and also in commissioned content. We do this by selecting expert authors in commissioned content, but when it comes to journalism, we're looking for diverse representation of points of view or indeed individuals we quote in our stories. So I wanted to share with you one vignette. So this is an example from commissioned content. One type of content that appears in Nature is called worldview. It's essentially one person's opinion. It's literally a single page piece in the printed journal. And it's an opinion. It's an opinion which tends to be timely, again, very focused, of course, on science. And so this is a quote, or more or less verbatim, from one of my colleagues who works on the opinion section of the journal. Often we approached by, established individuals who belong to a certain demographic, who has had, this particular demographic has had a lot of time and space to express their opinions. So we tend to say, not in these very words, but words to this effect, thank you very much for coming up with this wonderful idea. You make a very good point, but you, with respect, may not be the best person to communicate this particular issue. Do you in fact know someone else who may be better placed, more closer to the source, who could talk to us and actually write about it for us? And as you can probably imagine, A perfect illustrative example of this could be a story that comes from the Global South. If we, in the first instance, if we'd been approached by somebody, let's say, based in the UK or the US. This has actually allowed us to be, in my opinion, very successful in achieving gender balance for amongst the authors for Worldview. And so this year, for the first time, we will actually have more of these opinions authored by women than by men. Carrying on this theme of ethics and authors and authorship, and I will be sort of evolving this theme over the next couple of slides. So I mentioned already Nature was launched 150 years ago. I'm showing you here the masthead of the very first issue. And the quotes that I have here are Nature's mission statements. So the one at the top is the mission statement as it was back in 1869, and the one at the bottom in the lively cloud, you can see I'm not an artist, is our current mission statement. There are essentially only two things that have changed about this mission statement over the last 150 years. One is that our focus has changed. So, in fact, Nature was launched to be more like the Scientific American of today than what it is today. So our mission was first to serve the general public, whereas now for us that's a secondary goal. And first of all, we serve the scientists themselves. And the second thing that has changed is that 150 years ago our mission spoke about the men of science or scientific men. And needless to say, we don't speak about that anymore. We talk about scientists. And indeed, it's really wonderful to see how our authorship has changed over these years. Those of you who are in the gender bias in science section have seen the slide already. And of course, you will all know who the people on your left-hand side are. But this was the kind of demographic of authors that we saw back a century ago or so. Whereas, of course, today, the authors are very different. And what's really gratifying to see that it's not just the gender and the ethnicity of the authors that's changing, but actually quite a few other things about authors is changing. So here I'm showing you an example of a special which we published almost exactly a year ago on co-production of research. There's some really interesting ethical considerations in this kind of work when you're bringing individuals who you don't traditionally think of as scientists to design scientific studies in the first place. And in some cases, these individuals go on to become authors on papers. And you may think, I mean, probably astronomy is the best example where citizen science has actually played an important role. But there are many others, including disciplines that you may not necessarily think about, such as, for example, molecular biology. We had an example of a paper like this at the beginning of this summer. Now, all of this leads me up to spending a few minutes talking about ethics of authorship and author responsibility. And think back to what I said at the very beginning, that if you are an active researcher, you are a science communicator also. And so not only the ethics, when you think about ethics of your work, not only does it need to apply to the way you do science, but it needs to apply to the way you communicate it. And the way you communicate it, not just through outreach to the general public, but also through inreach to your own community. So these are principles that we expect our authors to adhere to, in particular our corresponding authors, who actually, if you think about it, carry the responsibility for the paper that they are a corresponding author on. And so I won't read this, you can glance over this. I don't think you will find anything surprising here. The fact that essentially your responsibility is to not only to do your research with rigor and ethics, but to report it with rigor and in an ethical way. And in the session this morning, there was a comment made in the context of responsibility of journals. In the very first plenary session, one of the speakers made a comment that the journals and the publishers are responsible for, or it's their ethical responsibility for the integrity of the figures and reporting the papers. We can take the responsibility, but the authors of those papers surely have the ethical responsibility for what it is that they put together and put forth to the journals and to their colleagues for their consumption. The next thing I want to mention in the context of ethics is author contributions. Papers these days in almost any discipline have an increasingly large number of authors in the author credits. It's increasingly difficult to discern who has contributed what to a paper, and I completely appreciate that this is extremely varied depending on the discipline. Nevertheless, if you think about how in many disciplines how scientific contributions are rewarded and how hires are made, it suddenly becomes very important where your name is in the list of 150, 300 people on the author's list, and how is anyone going to figure out if you are number 57 or 108, what your contribution was. So for Nature and Nature Research journals, quite some time ago, we introduced very granular contribution, author contribution statement, precisely to try and address this, but also to help with discerning the contributions on increasingly multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary papers. So moving away from ethical issues associated with authorship, I wanted to turn to editorial decision-making. What I'm showing you on this slide is the kind of guiding principles that we as editors use when we make decisions on papers. And very clearly for us, and again, we have an internal ethical code of conduct, and for us it's absolutely paramount that what we focus on is the science and the appropriate ethical consents that come with a particular study. So very clearly, if a study is seemingly robustly conducted but without appropriate ethical consents, this is not something that we will be considering for any further follow-up in our pages. When we talk about publication and responsibility associated with communicating your research and ethics that goes with it, we as editors feel that it's very important to facilitate post-publication discourse. Increasingly, right across the disciplines, there are platforms for pre-publication discourse. Of course, physicists in this room, I'm sure, laugh quietly when life scientists get very excited about preprints these days, because, of course, in the physical sciences archive has existed for something like a quarter of a century. This is a platform that life scientists and practitioners of other disciplines have only recently discovered. These are excellent fora for pre-publication discourse. Post-publication discourse is equally important. We feel that this is an ethical obligation that we have to enable that, and we have a number of formats that we allow this allow for this in our pages. I want to turn to peer review. Of course, everybody will agree with me, an absolute cornerstone of disseminating scientific discovery. I'm sharing with you this as a bit of a sort of amusing vignette, something which you will discover, like I have looking back through Nature's history. Brimble was one of the early editors-in-chief of Nature. Peer review itself is actually a relatively new invention. Of course, it only became routinely used in the 1960s, late 1960s, and more broadly in the 70s. So story has it that editor-in-chief at the time used to conduct this very informal peer review in this private club in central London, which was frequented by scientists and clinicians and various other men only, and on that basis, his decision making would be informed. Well, you'll be pleased to hear that this is not how it happens today. Well, of course, it's not my intention to talk about how we conduct peer review here, but I just want to focus your attention on the fact there are important ethical considerations to the whole process. And of course, there are ethical considerations from our perspective as editors who choose peer reviewers, how we evaluate those referee reports when they come back, and when do we actually veto those reports, come back to the reviewers to say, actually, your report is unacceptable for reasons, for example, that it doesn't focus on the research questions, but focuses on some personal dimension of what you've just read. And equally, of course, there's a complementary ethical dimension on the reviewer side as well. And I'll come back to that when I talk about conflict of interest. One interesting thing that I wanted to highlight for you, which I think plays an important role in, quite frankly, all of us behaving more ethically when it comes to peer review, is this concept of open peer review. So open peer review is, as a term, is used to mean actually a number of different things, which in itself is not very helpful. Some refer to open peer review as in publication first and peer review unfolding post-publication in real time for everyone to see. Others refer to open peer review when they mean that referee reports are published and signed. What I'm referring to here specifically is publication of referee reports not necessarily signed, that is at the discretion of the reviewer, but publication of referee reports with the published paper. So even if each of the reports is not attributed by name to an individual, we and other journals who participate in these trials or have gone down this route of transparent peer review have found that the quality of peer reviewing has actually gone up now that the reviewers know that their reports are going to be written. So when we think about ethics of science communication and science evaluation, I think that's something else that's important to keep in mind. So I promised a couple of times already that I will talk about conflict of interest, and I wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about this. This is something that we, again, take very seriously because we do think that it really lies at the heart of this ethical behavior for us as editors or journalists, but also for the peer reviewers we use and, of course, our authors. So it is a requirement by our publisher, Springer Nature, that all editorial staff declare any conflict of interest, whether it's financial or personal, as I mentioned before, that they feel conflict of interest that may influence their decision-making in any way. Just to give you an example, editors such as myself are former active researchers. Many of us have close friends, often family members, who are active researchers. In those cases, we would never, not only we would never handle those manuscripts, but we are actually blinded towards those manuscripts on any databases that we use. We invite our peer reviewers to exclude themselves in cases where there is significant conflict of interest, financial or otherwise. The same thing with authors. Authors must disclose and specify what conflict of interest they may have that pertains to the submitted manuscripts. Those declarations are then disclosed to peer reviewers in the interest of full transparency. Specifically on this conflict of interest and competing interests, for many years we only considered financial conflict of interest, but actually relatively recently, as you can see, last year, almost 2 years ago now, we've extended that definition of conflict of interest to include non-financial conflict. And I wanted to specify what it is that we include under this umbrella, because actually often it's not very clear. I think financial competing interests are much more clear than non-financial one. And here I'm listing some of them, such as, for example, unpaid membership in a government or non-governmental organization or an advocacy or lobbying organization, unpaid advisory position in a commercial organization, writing or consulting for an educational company or acting as an expert witness. These are just some examples that may come into play when either evaluating or offering a position on a specific topic. So, of course, when you think about ethics of science communication in the context of this in-reach, as I described it, so when communicating research to your community, and you work in biomedical fields, you think about bioethics and biosecurity issues. We have worked over the years to develop an extensive and very strict set of editorial and publishing policies associated with bioethics and biosecurity. And of course, this work is never done, as the guidelines offered by external bodies evolve as new technologies become available. These policies need to be revised. And so here are examples of some of the most important ones, in my opinion. So we have such policies for studies involving animals and human research participants. Of course, phase 2 and 3 clinical trials, tumor marker prognostic studies, clinical trial registration, human specimen, biospecimens, also transplantation studies. There's an important aspect to this, as well as the research on human participants, which involves groups, human groups, for whom it may be difficult to decide whether independent consent has been obtained, whether those people are in a position to actually consent or deny that consent for a particular study. Publishing images from human research participants, and then studies involving human embryos, gametes, and stem cells. For issues associated with biosecurity, we have an internal senior editorial group that monitors any papers that may possibly have such consideration, and we would evaluate these papers as a group and at first submission, but also following peer review. So in the final couple of slides, I wanted to mention other aspects which I consider, you may think of them as ethics associated with doing science, but to me, there's a continuum between doing science and then once it's done, once the experiments are finished, have those experiments and then reported. So what I'm sharing with you here is a mention of an effort, again, an ongoing effort. We as editors work with various communities, many of you here in the room, to devise these reporting summaries, reporting lists. As you see, we have them. We have a general one for life sciences, but others for specific subject areas. The example I'm showing is for solar cells. These are summaries which essentially prompt our authors to be rigorous and transparent in the way they report on the work that has already been done. This is not only a tool actually for us as editors, but it's an important tool for our reviewers. These summaries are published together with the papers, so it's a tool for anybody who then reads the paper themselves. What's interesting about this particular aspect is that we have feedback on these types of summaries from our community of authors who say that actually on some occasions they use these essentially blank forms to guide the study design subsequently. So that's why I'm saying that the reporting or the communication of science blends together with the doing of science, in my view, in a very satisfying way. And the final aspect that I will mention that to me is fundamental when we talk about ethics of science communication is indeed transparency of that communication. So in Nature and more broadly in the whole Nature research portfolio, We are very serious about sharing data, materials, and other so-called research objects. Sharing data is most advanced across all different research disciplines, and so we are most prescriptive when it comes to that. For example, all papers in Nature have to have data availability statements, and these statements are freely available, just as abstracts are to everyone. We expect the authors to specify what data have been obtained, where they are deposited, and if they're not deposited in a public database, how they can be obtained by researchers who may be interested in following up on that study. Again, another example where the ethics of doing science really blends with the ethics of communicating that research, in this case, to the specialists. So, this was my last slide, and in closing, I will just invite you again to think, when you think about ethics of science communication, I hope that by what I've shared with you, you will now think more broadly in that context, and you will think less in terms of a boundary between ethics of doing science and ethics of communicating science. And with this, I will stop and thank you.